Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Thanks so much for joining us. We come your way every Saturday, regularly from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. And we also are broadcast on A2Zen.fm. You want to check that website for the days and times. We say the listings, if you will. And then, of course, we archive this program at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. So lots of opportunities for you to check out our guests and the topics. And speaking of topics,
where I live, the sound of traffic is incessant. People everywhere, rushing about their lives. My name is Juliet. I'm an investigative journalist. My magazine sent me to write a profile of a spiritual community in Northern California and its founder, a man named Swami Kriyananda.
I want you to go there, take a look around. Think they have some answers? I want you to write an article on it.
The community is called Ananda, which means joy. On first glance, everyone seemed happy, but appearances can be deceiving. Spirituality and charismatic leaders made me think of cults. But when I met Kriyananda, those thoughts went away.
Spirituality is a free-flowing thing. You're living in grace, even though you may not know it.
At the age of 22, he became a lifelong disciple of the 20th century yoga master Paramahansa Yogananda. In 1968, he inspired a handful of young idealists to create the first Ananda community. Now Ananda communities are flourishing around the world. There was a story here, but it wasn't at all what I expected. It was a gathering place of extraordinary individuals, living their lives by an ancient science, both spiritual and practical. I learned about their teachings and how they put them into action.
A completely integrated life. The physical body, the mind, the emotions, and of course the spirit.
It's an exciting time in medicine because we now understand that the brain is really much more changeable than we ever realized. People that meditate regularly feel happy, feel like it's easy to learn new things, you feel creative, kinder, more empathy toward other people.
Community is really about people. We're able to live simply here because we know that happiness comes from inside.
We can probably define spirituality as, does it make you feel happy?
I'm happy, aren't I?
Imagine a world where the goal is finding happiness.
And that is the basic topic for today. Not only happiness, finding happiness, but also the movie, Finding Happiness. And with us is the, if I'm terming this correctly, I hope I am, the successor to Swami Kriyananda, Jyotish. And I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program. I have to say it's been quite a journey to get to this point, to say the very least. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. It's a joy to be able to chat with you today.
Now, we're also going to, I'm going to play a little clip in a little bit from where all of this began. And it actually began for me back at about the age of 17 when I read for the very first time the Paramahansa Yogananda's book, Autobiography of a Yogi. And I am in the present, I am rereading that. I happen to have it on audiobook, and I'm rereading this thing over and over and over again. And when I found out that there was the last remaining living teaching disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda in Swami Kriyananda, and his book came out, I was quite intrigued and very interested in talking with him and had a great opportunity to interview him here on this program. And it's nice to, I was hoping to be able to continue that tradition, as it were, but I found out rather shockingly that he had passed some 6 months prior to my investigating this process of this movie. But I'm grateful that we have the opportunity to see and hear him, both in the interviews that we have on our website, but also through this movie. And this village, this concept, this idea, this it's quite phenomenal. And I know that a lot of people are looking for, as we term here on this program, Jyotish, a new way of living. Tell me, as we start, how this idea began. Was it in the mind of Swami Kriyananda, or maybe even it goes back further than that?
Well, I think it goes back further than that, but I'll give you a little background of it. My life was changed by reading that book, Autobiography of a Yogi, and it was because of that book I had heard about a living disciple of his in San Francisco, and I went and met Swami Kriyananda there, and really, in a certain sense, together, we worked on founding Ananda Community, and since that time, the branch communities. But the ideal for an intentional community, and especially an intentional community with high ideals, was there before Ananda got started. Paramahansa Yogananda often spoke about that. He talked about them in terms of world brotherhood communities, places of high thinking and simple living, and he very, very much encouraged Swami Kriyananda in his interest. And Swami Kriyananda had an interest in intentional communities that far predated his meeting Yogananda. When he was a teenager, he had grown up in pre-World War II Europe, and he just saw how the world was going in directions that were going to lead to disaster, and he felt that on his own, that one way around that was for people of different races and nations to live together, and in living together, to share their lives together, get to know each other, and then that would be a counter to war, to greed, to a lot of negative aspects of life. So he was already thinking about communities and then was greatly spurred on in those thoughts by Yogananda. And I happened to be fortunate enough to meet him right at the beginning of the actualization of starting a community.
As I say, it is something that we're all sort of looking for. I've talked with so many different people in this regard, And it is, to say the very least, it's quite remarkable that the communities actually exist today. I think that that is one of the things that I think we dream about these things. We hope, we wish, if you will. You know, we go through all those particular aspects of who and what we are. And you know, we hope that one day we'll live this life. We'll live in a community that is supportive of us, and we are supportive of it, and so on and so forth. And that we can nurture and be nurtured in, and take our civilization to new levels. I think that's one of the things that we talk so much about on this program, is finding those new ways of living that will take us to that next level of existence. And I'm kind of wondering, from your perspective, and again, if I am paraphrasing correctly, what would you say that would be?
Well, I think there are a number of ways of approaching that, but I think, kind of coming back to what you were just expressing, that almost everyone feels like there has to be a better way to live than what we're seeing around us. There's too much disintegration in society, too much not caring about each other, not caring about the environment. I don't want to have to list all of the problems, because people generally know that there are a lot of problems. What is, by and large, missing is a viable solution to those problems. And I think that that's what Ananda represents for people, especially if they see the movie Finding Happiness, they see a viable alternative where there's an integration of life on all levels. There's integration with the environment around, where you live in harmony with the environment, you try to take care of it, it takes care of you. There's, at Ananda Village, we have many gardens, we take care of the forests, we have hundreds and hundreds of fruit and nut trees, so that there's a kind of a interaction environmentally that is very natural. And we've lost that, not so much in rural America, but we're losing it in rural America, but we've lost it in urban living everywhere around the world. And so resources are stretched, and so there is no natural integration with the natural environment around us. By and large, there is not very much integration socially with people. We hear stories about people who live in an apartment complex, and they've lived there for years, and they don't even know their neighbor. We read a story about someone who had lived in an apartment complex for 2 years, was moving out, and was loading up the van, and someone came by who also lived in the apartment complex, saw the moving van there, and said, "Oh, you're moving in. We're such a friendly group here. We all work together and know each other." And this family had lived there for 2 years without knowing anyone. And so there's a disintegration in society socially, economically. There's a big disconnect between haves and have-nots, and not very much real caring among people in many cases. And then finally, there's a spiritual disintegration where people don't feel that they are able to carry their spiritual ideals. I'm not talking religious here. I'm talking spiritual things such as joy and caring and compassion and all of those uplifted ideals that are shared by many religions. They aren't able to carry those into everyday life. And so when people see a model that we have an integrated lifestyle and an uplifted lifestyle on environmental, social, economic, and spiritual levels, they're naturally excited by it. We've been showing this movie, Finding Happiness, to groups of students in, we just returned from India, but we showed it at a college to about 200 students, and they were just awestruck with the possibility of living a life according to your ideals and actually having that life work and be successful. So I think even though the movement is very small, I think it's going to be very, very important as humanity moves forward in the next years and decades.
Well, I, you know, as I hear you speaking, and of course I've seen the movie, and it's extraordinary, just extraordinary. I was kind of, I was struck by the beauty that in Ananda Village that you live in and live around, or that is around you. And those spaces are becoming smaller and smaller, and yet I don't know how many acres you have there. I forget what the acreage that was mentioned was.
Close to 1,000.
But that's huge. I mean, that's that's enormous. And I don't know, again, I don't have all the statistics in front of me, or nor recalling from the film the number of people that are living there, or maybe people come and they go, and that type of thing. But it just seems to me that as you're not saying we want nothing to do with the technological part of our society. We're going to go primitive here. We're going to maybe, you know, sort of live like the Amish or the and so forth. No, you actually still incorporate modern aspects, if you will, aspects of our society into Ananda Village, so that you can live somewhat comfortably, but at the same time, there are things that need to be done. I mean, you were mentioning the fruit and nut trees. They don't, you know, they don't take care of themselves. They have to be maintained and watered and pruned, and the fruits have to be collected and so forth and so on. And that's just one aspect. I know you have lots of animals, and it's probably as close to self-sustaining as most communities are going to get. The point, if I'm correct, is this is not about cutting oneself off from the rest of society, is it?
No, not at all. In fact, it's really almost the opposite. We see society as cutting themselves off from each other. And what we're trying to do is not only live an integrated life here in a rural community, but to connect in many, many ways with the world around us, but in ways that are meaningful. For instance, we have we do a lot of things online, which allows us to connect. A couple of years ago, we looked at the end of the year, and people from 202 different countries had connected with Ananda. So that kind of web network allows us to integrate around the world in ways that is the opposite of being isolating. Just personally, my wife and I, who are, one could say, the primary organizational and spiritual leadership of Ananda, we travel all around the world, and so we're far, far from isolated, nor do we want to be isolated. And we have to find a way to live in the modern world in a way that works for our own humanity, not to reject the modern world, nor to live in a modern world in such a way that suppresses the natural needs for love, for connection, for compassion, for joy, for entertainment, for fun, for happiness. We have to find ways that we can create all of those without ignoring the fact that we live in a 21st century world and need to take advantage of what's good in that world, but leave behind some of the disintegrating aspects of it that are pushing people apart and, in fact, making them unhappy.
We're talking with Nayaswami Jyotish, and he is the successor. Tell me what that means. Not the Nayaswami. We'll talk about that later. But what does it mean to be the successor, if you will? Or is that the wrong term to use?
Well, it's the right term in a certain way. Every organization needs to have a clearly identified head of the organization. And in Ananda, that kind of combines, because our primary thrust is a very sincere spiritual search using techniques of meditation and the various techniques that were brought to the West and disseminated by Paramahansa Yogananda. And so the perpetuation of teaching other people techniques of how to meditate and related aspects of that, that's one aspect. So a spiritual organization needs a clearly defined head, and I, along with my wife, fulfill that role. And so it is, in one sense, a spiritual successor or successor to Kriyananda. On the other hand, he was a person of such, out-of-the-box talents that nobody could ever succeed him. I mean, the man was a multi-level genius. He wrote over 150 books. He wrote over 450 pieces of beautiful, beautiful music. So, you know, a writer, a musician, composer, he was artistic in many ways with photography and so on. He spoke 9 different languages, and he founded a whole community movement. So this is, there's a term that Malcolm Gladwell uses, outliers, where there are people of kind of extreme genius. And he was one of those people in the world and really has started or been a part of starting this whole movement of communities and spiritual integration. So nobody's ever going to really succeed him, but he's now gone from the world, and somebody needs to take on that role, and that role happened to fall to me and to a certain extent also my wife, partly because I was his first assistant and was basically his right-hand man for 45 years.
How did that impact you, not so much on a practical level, but on a personal as well as a spiritual level?
Oh, it really, one could begin and talk for hours on that. A friend of ours wrote a book called Shaped by Saints. And this man is an Indian, and he decided early in his life that he wanted his life and his mind to be shaped by saints. And so he traveled around meeting and spending time with saints. Well, I would say that my life was shaped by Swami Kriyananda. First of all, he gave hundreds and hundreds of classes in terms of spirituality, not just techniques of meditation and the practice of how to meditate and different aspects of that, but also hundreds of classes in how to apply high ideals to relationships, how to apply them to business, attitudes that will bring fulfillment. And so just being in association with him for 45 years, in close association, his thinking, which he would be the first one to say that he was simply an extension of the teachings given to him by Yogananda, who would say that he was simply an extension of the high-minded teachings both of ancient India and of uplifted consciousness of spirituality. And so the kind of lineage, I would say, that we're a part of is not just a practical spiritual path, but it's also how to bring those high ideals and apply them very practically to everyday living.
I have to say that when I first read the book, Autobiography, and obviously even subsequently, one of the thoughts I thought, boy, this what a life that would be. I mean, it's not a life of leisure. It's not an easy life. Many, many challenges, certainly. But the things that you would learn, the techniques, the practices, the discipline, raising one's awareness, one's self-awareness and consciousness and so on and so forth. And the thought that kept nagging at me was, yeah, but you're not Indian. You're not from India. You don't have the lineage. That's not your lot in life. Those were the kinds of comments that would come into my mind as if it was you had to be Indian, as it was a prerequisite in order to follow this man's teachings. I mean, Kriyananda was not Indian, as far as I know.
And nor is almost anyone at Ananda.
Yeah.
No, these teachings are universal.
Yeah.
They just happen to have taken root in India and had their formative centuries there. But they're universal, just as principles of business are universal. Now, principles of business, one could say, maybe have been explored more in America than in most other countries, but they aren't American. You don't have to be an American to apply principles of business.
Right.
Principles of medicine are universal all around the world. So the thought that you have to be Indian in order to follow these things, there is a Hindu religion with a lot of gods, and it seems very strange and esoteric, but the practices that we have only kind of tangentially touch the Hindu religion. They come out of that milieu because there are deep truths that have been explored for millennia in India, but those deep truths are practical all over the world. So, for instance, meditation,
mm-hmm.
simply stilling the mind and focusing on the inner aspect that is there in everyone and brings one to a universal consciousness. But stilling the mind, everybody in the world, Indians, Americans, South Americans, Africans, Norwegians, everyone has a mind. Everyone has certain emotions. Everyone has basically the same nervous system and physiology. Doesn't matter where on the planet you live. So it would be no more correct to say that meditation is Indian than it would be to say sleep is Indian. Everybody in the world needs to sleep. Everybody in the world has access and can have their life improved if they learn how to still and concentrate their mind and awaken their inner connection to their own joy, to their own love, to their own peace and calmness and wisdom. These things are universal, and when you connect to your own, let's say peace, you connect to your own inner peace, then you find that that peace is residing in the hearts of everyone, and you feel connected to everyone in the world.
Mm.
Same with joy, same with love. It may be expressed slightly differently in different cultures, but these are universal principles.
We're talking with Nayaswami Jyotish, and we're talking about the movie called Finding Happiness. We're talking about its founder, Kriyananda, Swami Kriyananda. We're talking about its origins in Paramahansa Yogananda and Autobiography of a Yogi that both our guest and I have read probably numerous times. And we're going to continue talking because that's what this is about in terms of telling your story. Tell me your story, New Paradigms for a New World. And we will be right back.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you. Oh, won't you walk with me?
I've never met anybody so great as he. Just looking into his eyes, it was like looking into eternity. There was no ego there. There was only a desire to serve and to help other people. There was a garden party in Beverly Hills. He was invited to give the talk. He began with the most powerful talk I've ever heard in my life. He said, "This day marks the beginning of a new era."
And indeed, it is a new era here on AM 1290. And Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and we're joined by Nayaswami Jyotish. And we're talking about the movie Finding Happiness. We're also talking about Swami Kriyananda and Paramahansa Yogananda and kind of opening this whole thing up. And again, I'm certainly grateful for the time that you have given us to talk with you about all of this. What I'd like to talk to you about now is your relationship and your connection with Kriyananda, Swami Kriyananda. Not so much when you first met him and all of those kinds of things, but you know, it's funny when I think about how I found out when I found out that about his passing. I mean, I couldn't believe. There's a part of me that when I received the reply and the information about his passing back in April or May, I'm going, oh, I feel kind of stupid. I should have known that. At the same time, I was thinking, oh my gosh, I've missed an opportunity. I really was looking forward to speaking with him again. And I know that everyone associated with him still, I'm sure, is sort of sharing in that same sentiment. And yet he left such an unbelievably huge and important and significant legacy.
Yeah, his legacy was, I don't know, enormous. Partly through his books, partly through his lectures, but more importantly than any of that was that he was just a channel in the world for compassion, for wisdom, for kindness. He was the kindest person I've ever known. He would go out of his way to go up to strangers and just give them a little bit of energy. He would often, just walking down the street, he would see somebody that was looking a little forlorn or a little lonely, and he would just stop and he'd say, oh, what a beautiful scarf you're wearing. That's such a beautiful color. I feel blessed when somebody wears such a beautiful color. It's almost as if you're wearing it to help me. And he would do that to strangers, something of that nature. And they would just feel that somebody cared, somebody valued them. But it wasn't like it was anything that was a technique. It was just he had so much joy and love in himself that he naturally wanted to share that with everybody. And so he probably touched, I would guess that he probably lectured to 100,000 people during his lifetime, and then maybe more. And then by the reach of the internet and recorded talks, it's many, many, many millions of people. He had a program in India, a television program, that reached 25 million households. And so he had an enormous impact on reaching people. And it wasn't about him as a personality. It was much more about certain principles that that he felt were important to live a life that is based on searching for happiness, not for just material goods, to live in such a way that you care about other people and connect to other people, to live in such a way that your thoughts become more uplifted. The what you read, the music that you listen to, all have influences, and if you choose the right influences, they can help you to be happy and more expansive. And if you choose the wrong ones, they'll help you to become more self-centered, worried, anxious-filled, and even in its extreme, violent in order to protect yourself.
It is quite an endeavor, I'm sure. And as you said, no one can replace Swami Kriyananda any more than anyone can replace Paramahansa Yogananda or any other individual who leaves that kind of a lasting legacy and touches so many lives. But I'm curious as to what your plans are in terms of the kind of legacy you want to leave.
Well, that's an interesting question. I haven't really thought about it very much. I don't think so much in terms of legacy than I think in terms of living with integrity and righteousness day to day. I guess the accumulation of that becomes a legacy. But Ananda has, from Kriyananda, has a couple of basic tenets. And even in his will, where, in fact, he named me as his successor, even in his will, he talked about how that it was very important to perpetuate these fundamental ideals. One is that if you act righteously, that will lead you to success and victory in whatever you're doing. And if you don't, the Indian term for righteous action is dharma. If you act with dharma, then that will lead to a successful life. And if you act against dharma, against righteousness, for instance, if you lie or if you cheat or if you somehow con people, even if you achieve a temporary success, it will ultimately lead to failure and failure inside. So the statement is it's a statement that was a slogan for a Maharaja in India, but it's where there is righteousness, there is victory. So that's one tenet, and that means that we need to live, and I very, very much am in tune with that, that we need to live our life in such a way that the choices we make are righteous, they include the welfare of other people, they include the welfare of the world as a whole, they aren't the kind of actions that provide some temporary little benefit for yourself at the cost of someone else. So that's one principle. The other fundamental principle of Ananda is that people are more important than things. And the way that that translates is that, for instance, if we're doing a business, the welfare of the employees is more important than the success of the business. But that if you watch out for your employees, meaning that you make sure that their needs are being met, not just financial needs, but needs for kindness and for support and for the kind of boss that cares about them and doesn't just use them. If you care about people and you make sure that they know that they're important, then success follows from that. So people are more important than things. And we have often in the history of Ananda put a person in a position not because they were qualified to do the work, but because that position would be good for their growth. And conversely, we have sometimes not put a highly qualified person into a position because they wouldn't grow from that. Maybe somebody, I don't know, who is, one might say, overly intellectual and has been doing detailed accounting work their whole life. Rather than put them into a position of accounting, we might have them working with people because they wouldn't learn anything more from doing more books and more accounting. But working with people, caring about them, teaching them, helping them, maybe working in a school with children, that would be growthful for them. And so we look at the needs of individuals. And if the world around us functioned just with those two fundamental principles, that act righteously and success will follow, and treat people as the most important things, not the projects, it would be a huge change and a huge improvement in the world around us. So I think the legacy that I'm likely to leave, if one can talk, it seems kind of an elevated almost, I'm a little uncomfortable with even the thought of leaving a legacy, but since we're on the subject, is one of deep integrity, deep caring about other people, and deep I don't know, a sense of doing what is right because it's right to do it, regardless of the consequences.
Each one of us in our lifetime have visions. What I mean by that is we have a dream for something to be created. And Paramahansa had his own visions based, I'm certain, on much higher calling and principle, as did Kriyananda, Swami Kriyananda. And I'm wondering about carrying on his work, and are you carrying his vision, or do you have your own? That, and again, I do understand that this whole lineage has almost quite a similar vision. I mean, in other words, that's kind of the string, that the silver strand or gold strand that runs through this whole entire lineage in terms of raising humanity up to a new level. Do you have that same vision that Kriyananda had?
Yes, I would say very much. And in fact, I would say I have a very much a conscious attempt to not create my own vision as much as to tune into the righteousness or tune into the vision. The way I would term it is that I am trying to attune my individual will to the will of the divine and to be a channel for the will of the divine. And so I'm a little bit leery about creating too much of my own vision.
Mm-hmm.
So, because attunement with the divine will is more important. Having said that, that divine will has to function through the filter, one might say, of every individual. And so I'm also aware that I have certain kinds of tendencies, certain ways of thinking, and those ways, in many cases, are very similar to Kriyananda's. In other ways, are somewhat different. He was more of a philosopher, he spent much more of his time writing books as an author and as a philosopher. I would say I'm probably more practical in my approach. Sometimes I've thought about communities that Kriyananda was like the architect, and he created the vision for a community and drew some of the drawings, but he never really built a building. And I was more like the contractor that took that vision and tried to apply it in everyday life and built the buildings, not just me alone, but many, many of us involved with Ananda. So he was more of a visionary, and I'm probably more of a hands-on kind of person. And so, you know, however many years I have as the head of Ananda, 10, 15, 20 more years, it will have a certain imprint. But I hope that imprint is always absolutely in tune with the divine will, and I'm trying my best to be a clear and focused and very enthusiastic, willing channel for the divine will to happen, because I think that through that, certain changes will come into the world that no individual could do on their own.
As I peruse your website as well, that is an extension of ananda.org for people who are interested. I see, of course, you had mentioned the book on meditation and the art and science, I believe it is, of meditation.
Right.
As well as the lessons, and there's some other materials as well, how to meditate. The question that, well, I'm going to ask this question first before I go into the meditation issue. The movie is entitled Finding Happiness. And in the preamble to the Constitution of the United States, it gives us as citizens the right to life, liberty, and it doesn't say and happiness. It says the pursuit of happiness. And my question is more along the lines of trying to better understand the difference between what I've read in both Kriyananda's work as well as Paramahansa, the difference between happiness, joy, and bliss, as referred to many times, the blissful state. And because we live in a dualistic world, the world of Maya, you always have the counter. If you have laughter, you have tears.
Right.
If you have joy, you have sorrow. If you have happiness, you have sadness. But I don't hear that duality when I hear bliss or the blissful state. It is not an emotional state. Can you give us, elaborate on that for us, would you please?
Okay. Well, if you were to strip away all sense of personality, all sense of what I would call ego. Now, ego is the identification with your body and your personality. Kriyananda also defined one time ego as a bundle of self-definitions. So strip away all those self-definitions. What remains? Well, the Indian scriptures say that three things remain. First of all, existence remains because we exist and we will always continue to exist. Awareness remains because without awareness, we wouldn't even be cognizant of our existence. And then the third thing, the third absolutely fundamental quality is bliss or joy. In Indian terminology, it's called Satchitananda. But so think of it that we exist, we are conscious, and we are joyful. And those are the three basic attributes of who we are. Now, when you take that concept and you apply it to how we live our life, and to come back to the Constitution, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's almost a restatement of that. Life is existence. Liberty, one could say, liberty for what? Liberty to explore. Liberty to be aware. Liberty to live a life. And then the pursuit of happiness is a statement about trying to find our own innate bliss again. Now, as you say, there's a dualistic world. So if you take the pure state of bliss and you kind of, diminish it a few octaves, then you find that it gets expressed in the personality as the desire to, everyone is searching for their own bliss, but they interpret that as the search for happiness. And for a long time, that search for happiness, something gets substituted for it. So people don't think of why they want a better job, why they want more money. It just seems, well, of course I want more money. I want more money because I can buy more things or I can be more secure. But why do they want more things? Why do they want to be secure? Because they think that if they have that, they will be happy. And if they don't have it, they'll be unhappy, or at least there's the potential for them to be unhappy. And so we substitute all of these things outside of ourselves for what we really want, which is inner happiness. And what inner happiness is really about is to find our own innate bliss. Someone once defined bliss as happiness without a cause. And it's kind of Right, but I would say bliss is really much, much deeper than that. But truth is stilling of the mind. When we begin to get on the spiritual path, not religious, but spiritual, one of the things that happens is that we begin to look at the question of what am I trying to do in life, and we try to look inside of ourselves, either through contemplation, through prayer, through whatever means we have, and we begin to find that happiness not only doesn't lie outside of ourselves, it lies within ourselves, but also that happiness is a choice that we can make, and we can get a conscious control over whether we're happy or not. I would call that a spiritual search, because spiritual in the sense that what we're looking for is our own innate joy or own innate bliss that doesn't depend on anything outside of ourselves. And when we find that, then we find that that's a universal quality, not an individual quality. And so that I would say is a spiritual search. But yes, the counterpart of that is that if you search for something outside of yourself, for fulfillment outside of yourself, there's always a plus and a minus, because we enter into the world of duality in which there's always happiness, counterpart with unhappiness, light with dark, a love with hatred. And we see the world around us being driven by these dualities, and to a certain extent, the search for a spiritual solution, the search for eternal bliss, is the switching of an external search to an internal search.
Hmm. I have been carrying that question around with me, waiting for the right opportunity, and this was it, because it always seemed to me, as I read about this, and I even have asked the question in regards to where we came from and where we're going and where we are. Where we came from and where we're going is oneness.
Right.
Where we are is duality, and that's always perplexed me. Why? What is the purpose of this duality? And, of course, people, we wanted the experience and so forth. And I'm going, well, wait a minute. We were the one. We were in the one. We were the one. What did we need with these experiences? And, well, because we wanted them. You know, and it's like, well, wait, doesn't that imply that something was lacking in the one, that these experiences were desired in the first place? Because that's what I've always, and maybe I'm misinterpreting something somewhere, but that's what I've always heard in terms of desires, certain desires, that, well, if there's a desire that you have, then it's because there's a lack in your life. You're thinking that there's something missing when there really isn't.
Well, Richard, that's an interesting question, and certainly one that I've chewed on. I've put it to my own kind of bemusement as, what happened? Did God get so bored that he had to create a world?
Yeah.
What's all about? But Kriyananda gave a very interesting answer to that. There's a traditional answer in India, which is God wanted to enjoy himself through many. And so there's that, but that it doesn't really, why did he want to enjoy himself through many? Kriyananda's answer, it's very intriguing, and an intriguing one to meditate on. He said it is the very nature of bliss, which is innate within us. It is the very nature of bliss to want to expand itself.
Mm.
And so that expansion of bliss ends up in a kind of desireless desire to see not just the one point of bliss, but potential billions and billions, trillions of points of bliss. And so that one point, one could say almost like what they talk about in the Big Bang theory, that there's a point of unity singularity, they call it, and then there's an explosion. Well, that point of singularity, if you say that that singularity is the singularity of bliss, the reason for that explosion that creates the universe is that bliss wants, it's innate in that bliss to want to expand. And so it expands into what seems to be trillions of points of bliss rather than the singularity, and yet it's all actually done in consciousness rather than in atomic, you know, atoms and molecules and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But that one singularity of bliss is now enjoying the potential bliss in trillions of points, and it does that not because it's bored, but because the very nature of bliss is to want to expand.
Mm. I like that. I will take me some time to ingest and digest that. But
true.
It certainly is, there's no question, it is great food for thought. This whole concept of the Ananda Village and what the movie brings to the attention of people, there are villages like this all over the world. You've started some in India, and I know that I believe they're just all over the place.
Right.
That have been started by Kriyananda and this whole process. But there are villages that are not associated with Ananda Village and Kriyananda that are doing similar kinds of work. They're working towards basically that same kind of goal. Of a better life, a higher life, and so forth. And I guess the one thing that intrigues me the most is how individuals can know of some of these great ancient writings, and nowhere have I ever read in any of them that it says that man was created to be a consumer producer.
Yeah, right.
And I don't see animals playing that role of consumer producer. They're like, they're living their lives.
Yeah. You know, there's a great Indian woman saint of the last century. She, Anandamoyi Ma.
There's
a whole chapter in the Autobiography of a Yogi.
Mm-hmm.
She had a beautiful statement. She said that the natural food of the mind is bliss that we were talking about.
Mm.
We will always be hungry until the mind is able to feast on its own bliss. But then she went on to say, but people who are hungry will search out food in any way that they can find it. So don't condemn people that are looking for it through money or through power or through fame. They're just hungry. They haven't found their own internal bliss, which is fulfilling. So they're trying to find something to chew on that they think will fill them up, but ultimately it doesn't. So they go from thing to thing to thing to thing, and it just is one of the problems of the restlessness of mankind. Was part of that process is a person who is eating some food that's not very nutritious, they get into their mind the thought, well, the reason I'm hungry is I haven't eaten enough of this food.
Mm.
So if they think that money makes them happy and they find out that they've got a couple of $1,000,000 and they still aren't happy, they don't automatically realize that, well, by golly, money does not make me happy. No, the first thought is, the reason I'm not happy is I don't have enough money. And so they work for more money. Or if they think things are going to make them happy, and they find that their life is kind of empty, and they've still got a lot of things, they don't think, well, things aren't going to make me happy. They think, I don't have enough things. And so they become consumer producers, one trying to make more money, the other trying to get more things.
Yeah.
And it gets run, the world runs on that false hope and false expectation. And honestly, if we all became yogis and really saw that our happiness didn't depend on anything outside of ourselves, it wouldn't be very good for the economy as it is now in its currently overblown cycle.
Yeah.
Because we tend to live simply. That was one of Yogananda's principles, high living and simple high thinking and simple living, not high living and simple thinking. That's wrong. High thinking and simple living.
Right.
And that kind of doesn't really help the gross national product. But I love what the king of Nepal substituted for the gross national product. He wanted to have a measurement of the gross national happiness.
Oh, I like that. I heard about that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love that. And did that ever get put into play?
Yeah, in fact, it has. And in fact, they have changed a lot of their institutions. Schooling, for instance, our schooling tends to be in the West, tends primarily to be focused around creating an educational system that prepares you to make money. And make more money, and so they've substituted educational system, the goal of which is to make you happy, and so they're working on many grassroots level and really taking quite seriously the fact that they want consciously as a whole country to substitute monetary values, would substitute happiness values for monetary values.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
Because quite honestly, the current system under which we're living, the current social structure and system, has killed and will kill millions more if we continue down this road. I mean, it is a stress-driven system, and the human body cannot withstand that kind of stress for a lifetime. Without some very sad repercussions. Before we wrap up our program, because I'd love to go continue down this particular road, but I have four other questions that I need to get to before we wrap up. One of them has to do with meditation. And I'm going to ask you, because you have a book on meditation, teaching people step by step how to meditate and so forth, the art and science. What is, if we can put it in this context, the purpose, the goal of meditation?
Excuse me. I would say the purpose is to get in touch with your own innate bliss. And when you do that, you will find that that bliss resides everywhere. And you'll feel a unity with all people, all things. You go beyond time, beyond that bliss is eternal. So the purpose of meditation, actually, Yogananda defined meditation as deep concentration on God or on one of the aspects of God. And one of those aspects is bliss. Another is love. Another is peace, calmness, light, sound. So the techniques of meditation are meant to control the life force in such a way that you're able to deeply focus the mind, and you deeply focus the mind either on God or on one of those aspects, and those aspects you find reside within yourself. So meditation turns the spotlight of the mind internally to look for your own internal qualities, and those are universal qualities.
Who is Nayaswami Jyotish Novak?
Well, in the deepest sense, he's an aspect, he's an extension of God, he's a point of bliss that has reincarnated over and over, gathered certain tendencies, certain qualities, certain habits of thinking, and then he's been born in this life and is playing out the kind of lesson plan that will allow him to get to the point where he realizes once again his eternal nature and his own eternal blissful nature. But so I'm an aspect of God that has become particularized according to the very individual, history of experiences and thoughts and attitudes that I have. And if I identify myself as that grouping of attitudes and thoughts, then I end up thinking I'm separate. If I identify myself as the divine just temporarily inhabiting those attitudes and experiences and thoughts, then I have an avenue to reach back to my own divinity again.
Mm. What is it that you hope to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I would say, first of all, I hope to achieve my own liberation, meaning my own self-realization, so that I know in every fiber of my being that my reality is as an extension of the divine. I would say, furthermore, I would hope to be a kind of channel for light, for love, for kindness, for a channel of, as a teacher, to give techniques by which people can feel happier, feel more expanded. And so I would one, be looking for achieving self-realization, and secondly, be looking to share whatever uplifted consciousness I would have with everyone, and to do that as freely, enthusiastically, and energetically as possible, without any expectation that they need to accept my way of living, nor do they need to thank me or give money to me, or I'm not in it for anything coming back. I'm just there to share because I've been given something so valuable for myself.
And how powerful are we as human beings?
As egos, not too powerful.
Nice definition.
Yeah, as extensions of the divine, we are so powerful that we could create and destroy universes.
Mm. Are you optimistic about our future, humanity's future?
Yes, I am very optimistic. I think we're going through a time where we're in a growth cycle. The future will grow more and more, spiritually uplifted. But we also have a past, and we have a lot of people who are very afraid of change, and that fear produces a kind of fundamentalism that, out of its own insecurity, is trying to impose its model on other people. And so I think, you know, if you look at the Taliban, that are trying to impose their way of life on the people around them, even if they have to kill them to do so, they're doing that out of fear that their old ways are going to come to an end. Well, the world is moving ahead. Consciousness is moving ahead. Integration in the world is expanding. And those old isolated, conflicting models are under threat, and they are going to die, but they're kind of like the dinosaurs going through their death throes. Mm. They're still dangerous, but they won't live for more than, a few hundred years more, yeah. Maybe less than that. But between now, someone said, there's the old statement that when God closes one door, he opens another. He said, that may be true, but it's hell in the hallways.
I love that. I want to thank you so much, Jyotish, for joining us here on the program, sharing your story and the story of the film as well as of Swami Kriyananda. And we look forward to having you back again. If you find yourself here in the Santa Barbara area, we would love to have you in studio for an interview.
It would be my pleasure. I really enjoyed it, Richard.
I would also love the opportunity to come out to Ananda Village. Just seeing it in the movie was spectacular, but I'm sure seeing it face-to-face, as it were, 10 times that, 100 times that, I'm sure.
Oh, you really should. And be sure to contact my wife and I.
I will.
If you're planning to come, we would love to have you come.
Wonderful. Well, we'll look forward to that. And again, my thanks to you. The movie is entitled Finding Happiness, and it's available. Is it available through the website, ananda.org?
The links to it are available through that.
Okay.
And also, there's a website called findinghappinessmovie.com.
Okay, you can buy the DVD. You can watch the trailer.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, if the trailer doesn't draw you in, I don't know what else will. It was. I must say, it was so well done. And the only other question I have for you, when I was watching, I showed this. My wife and I both watched the movie, and I was quite taken by his emotion when he was speaking. The pieces,
yes,
that he was shown. And I got the sense that this was quite genuine as he shared these moments.
Very, very genuine. No, it was a very poignant time. The actress who plays the reporter, Juliet, is a wonderful person, Elizabeth Rome, a wonderful person, not only a very, very fine actress, but a deeply spiritual person herself. And there was a chemistry and a resonance where she was asking him in a very genuine way, what is meaningful in your life? And that was a very poignant thing for him to share.
Mm-hmm.
So, those emotions were very genuine.
It was fantastic. It really was. Again, thank you so much. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.